Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. Around the world, there are very many people, a large number of people, maybe even millions of people we're talking about, people who have neurological disorders that disrupt their ability to move or to communicate. Now, these are people that have functioning brains, but because of injury or disease, the output of their brains cannot get to the parts of the bodies that should receive those signals. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the effort to develop medical devices to, in a sense, bridge that gap. And our guest for the program is Victor Chase. He's the author of the book Shattered Nerves, How Science is Solving Modern Medicine's Most Perplexing Problem. The book, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press, came out last fall, has been well reviewed, in fact was selected as one of the best science books of 2006 by the Library Journal. I'm sure that you can find it in a bookstore or in the library. A lot of interesting things in here as it explores the potential for implants that would make it possible for people who are blind to have at least partial sight, for deaf people to hear, and for people who are paralyzed, once again, to be able to move. As we talk about some of this work this morning, of course, questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana. The number 333-9455, and we do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Chase, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Just the kind of metaphor, I guess we want to encourage people to think about, and this is it's good enough to use as a metaphor, although it's perhaps not absolutely correct, but is to think of the body kind of like an electrical system, and that the impulses that move and connect the brain to our limbs and to the eyes and to the ears. It's kind of like electricity. It's not exactly like the way electricity goes through a copper wire, but it's electricity nonetheless. And what we're talking about here is the kind of problem, either it's an injury or it's a disease, something where it is as if we've come along with a clippers and cut the wire. That's essentially the thing. And that what we're looking at is some way to, again, not literally reconnect the two parts, but manage to get the impulse, the electricity, the current, or whatever you want to call it, from one side to the other. Basically, is that basically it?
Well, actually, yes, that is quite correct. The field of medicine or medical technology that I've written about in my book is called neuroprosthetics, and that's an umbrella term that covers a wide range of prosthetics. And as a matter of fact, I describe them in the book very much as you did, in that they basically bridge damaged circuitry. And the unifying area, or the unifying theme, if you will, of neural prosthetics is that they all interact with the nervous system. And the nervous system operates basically on electricity. And it's very similar to an electrochemical motor, if you will. Mm-hmm. The brain, the nerves in the brain create electricity, and they are sent from the axons, which send to the run from the cell body in the neuron, which is the nerve cell in the brain, to the end, where it releases, and that's an electrical signal, if you will, where it releases neurotransmitters, which are picked up by the dendrites, which is from the neighboring neurons, and those dendrites use those, the neurotransmitters are chemicals. Those chemicals are picked up by the neighboring dendrites, and they then create in the cell electricity and shoot it along the cell out the next axon where the neurotransmitters are again created, and that's how the neurons, the cells in the brain talk to each other. Similarly, the electrical signals are sent from the brain down the spinal cord to the muscles. The electrical signals is what activate your muscles. And the same works in reverse. Your brain receives signals in the form of electricity from your sensory organs, your eyes, your ears, and so on. And so neuroprosthetics replace damaged circuitry, and that's exactly how it works, right?
Just to take a little bit of a side question, because this is about a different area, but it's related. We know that, have known for a long time, that if, for example, you have a broken bone, if you take the two parts of the bone and you put them together and you provide some support, and it's possible also to actually encourage that process, but it essentially it will do it by itself, that the bone will re-knit and that it will heal that up. Well, basically, perhaps with some rare exceptions, nerves will not do that.
That's correct.
Why is it that, do we know really why that is, that nerves will not regenerate, will not, you can't cut a nerve and then just put the two pieces together and have them and join up again. They just won't
well,
do it.
Well, I don't, you know, if it was known, I think they'd be regenerating them right now. And there is research going on for nerve regeneration, and stem cell research is looking into that as well. And as a matter of fact, that will likely, very possibly, be the ultimate resolution for people who have nervous system damage, who have these broken circuits, if you will. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, even the neuroprosthetic researchers who are developing these implants, some of them have said as well that these implants will be sort of a stopgap measure, because they will probably come along to be clinically viable well before nerve regeneration does.
Yeah. Well, let's give an example of one. There's one of the first things you write about in the book. I think it's relatively easy for people to understand, and it's also a kind of technique that now it's been done for some time. And it's now certainly progressed beyond, I think it's fair to say it's progressed beyond the point where it's considered to be experimental because of the number of people who have had it and how successful it's been, and that's the cochlear implant.
That's correct, right.
To explain what a cochlear implant is and what it does.
Well, in the vast majority of the people who are deaf who lose their hearing, it is the hair cells in the cochlea, which is in the inner ear. It's a snail-shaped portion of the inner ear, and there are hair cells along there. And again, this harkening back to what we just talked about, the electricity is what operates the nervous system in the body. Without it, you wouldn't think, you wouldn't move, we wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for electricity. So here's a case where the sensory organ, in this case the ear, and there's the outer, the middle, and the inner ear, and the sound comes in and vibrates various bones and membranes within the ear, and it causes, if you will, an agitation of the hair cells. As these hair cells are being agitated, they create electricity. The electricity is then sent to the along the auditory nerve, which is just right adjacent to the hair cells in the cochlea, to the auditory cortex, to the brain, where the sounds are processed. And that's how it works. The cochlear implant what goes into the cochlea. I said it's a very small, snail-shaped system within the inner ear. And they fish it looks sort of like a curled piece of fishing line, if you will. It's that small, which is snaked inside the cochlea. And this little piece of line has little dots of metal along the way, which are electrodes. And the electrical signals, what happens is there's an external processor which picks up, has a microphone that picks up sounds much as your outer ear does. It has a transducer, and then it has a speech processor, and that processes the sound, and it transmits it to a decoder, And actually, the transmitter is external, and it's worn on the outside of the skull. There is no direct connection. The implanted inside the skull is a receiver and the decoder, and the external transmitter is magnetized, and it pops. It's worn behind the ear, and it pops on to the back of the head just as a refrigerator magnet does. And the information and the power to operate the system is transmitted via radio waves to the transmitter, and that is then sent along this small little wire to the coil that's embedded inside the cochlea. And the cochlea is very neatly tonotopically arranged, with the low frequencies being at one end and progressing on up to the higher frequencies. So what they do is they send in signals, pulsate them in, and that replaces the damaged hair cells and sends electricity or impulses directly to the auditory nerve. Mm-hmm. One of the very interesting things about the cochlea implant, which is very encouraging for other implants that send signals to the brain, is the fact that when it was first being developed in the mid-1900s, 1970s, 1980s even, a lot of people thought that thousands of electrodes would be required for a user to be able to make out coherent speech with this, because there are 30,000 hair cells in the cochlea. And to replace those damaged hair cells with a couple of electrodes was thought to be, by many people, impossible. And the first cochlea implants had, the very first one had one electrode. And then some more advanced experimental ones had as many as six electrodes. And actually, one of the people I interviewed for my book, a patient who had one of the early experimental cochlea implants, had an implant that had six electrodes, four of which were operational. And I carried on a telephone conversation with him very naturally, much as I'm speaking with you. Mm-hmm. And he was able to clearly understand what I was saying. So that speaks to the plasticity of the brain and the fact that given a very little bit of information, the brain is able to fill in a lot of blanks. And it is hoped that the same will be true with retinal implants, which are not quite that far along, although they are being tested in humans today.
Yeah. So that's, I think we ought to be clear and make sure people understand it. With a cochlear implant, it's not possible to take someone who is deaf and restore full hearing, but that it is possible to make it a lot easier, as you say, easier for them to recognize speech and do things with auditory input. And apparently it's the people who do best with the cochlear implant are those people who actually were born hearing and for some reason then later in life lost it.
Well, that's not necessarily so.
Huh.
First of all, cochlear implants, the implants today have, the modern ones have something like 22 electrodes in them.
Yeah.
And the majority of people with cochlear implants can carry on conversations over the telephone.
Yeah.
And so the ability to hear speech, to be able to discern speech, is relatively widespread, although not all cochlear implantees have successful experiences with their cochlear implants. I don't mean to imply that. And actually, young deaf children, as young as 6 months of age, are being implanted with cochlear implants. And that's why I said they are actually doing the best. And because they are growing up with the sounds created by the cochlear implant as being their native sounds, if you will, they are, by the early grades of school, doing just as well with speech as our normal hearing children.
Hmm. Let me introduce again our guest, Victor Chase. He is a science and technology writer. He has written for a number of publications, just to name a few: Air and Space, MIT's Technology Review, Popular Science, Science Digest, and others. And he is the author of the book Shattered Nerves: How Science is Solving Modern Medicine's Most Perplexing Problem. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press, and surveys some of the work being done in the area of neural prosthesis. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So we talked a little bit about the idea of the cochlear implant, that what it does, that it takes auditory material and it transforms that into a kind of an impulse that can be transmitted through the implant and directly to the nerves in the ear.
That's correct.
There is, as you say, there is a kind of a similar research is being done. It's not as far along, but it's a kind of a similar device, a retinal implant, which would take, what it does is it takes a small camera and it takes that information from the camera and in the same way hooks into the visual areas of the brain. And the idea is that in a similar sort of way, that it could take that visual information that the eye would pick up, collected by a camera, and transmit it directly to the parts of the brain that should be receiving it, and that that someone who is blind could be receiving some kind of visual information. I'm sure, again, it would not be the same as a normally functioning eye. At what point is this research, and how good is it? What is it that people are actually seeing, if we want to put that in quotes, who have retinal implants?
Right. Well, there are two types of retinal implants being experimentally implanted in people today. The one that is probably most widely being tested and the one that most experts think has the greatest promise is what's called an epiretinal implant. The other kind is a subretinal implant. And the epiretinal implant is an implant that is placed on the retina, and the retina is the part of the eye that takes, just as the hair cells, well, actually, the retina has a number of layers of cells in it. One of the layers of cells are the rods and the cones. And the rods and the cones are what take the light that enter your eye and, translates that light into electrical pulses. And initially, they translate the light into analog electrical pulses. And then as these electrical pulses pass through the other layers of the retina, they are transmitted to digital pulses. So obviously Mother Nature, long before we did, knew that digital was the most efficient way to send information. And that is sent to the optic nerve, and the optic nerve, which connects, if you will, in the back of the eye, and that sends the signals off to the visual cortex of the brain, where the electrical signals are processed into visual perception. And the visual cortex of the brain, by the way, takes up a lot of the cortex of the brain. It's a very complex part of the brain. But the rods and cones are what translate the light into electrical energy. Now, the epiretinal retinal implants that we're talking about are put on the inside of the retina, if you will, or on the top of the retina. The retina lines the back of your eye. And there have been a number of patients who have had these little implants put into the retina of their eye with 16 electrodes in them. And as you described, there's an external camera that picks up the light, and very much as the microphone picks up the sound with the cochlear implant, and then that light is processed. And actually, in the early implants, they are using an cochlear implant processor, while they're developing a more advanced one specifically designed for retinal implants to process the information and send it. And it's much the same way. There's a external apparatus that snaps as magnetized, pops onto the back of the head. There's an area in the skull where there's little they gouge out a small area in the skull, and they put the processor and the receiver in there, and it takes the signals and sends them off to the electrodes that are on the retina itself. And the people who have received these implants are able to see individual spots of light. Now, with only imagine having, for example, a dot matrix printer with only 16 dots. You couldn't make out much specifically, but they can see these dots of light as their head scans and the camera picks up light. These electrodes do come on, and they look as they describe it, like little spots of light. And the idea is to increase the number of electrodes. The next generation will have 60 electrodes, and go on from there. And as I mentioned with the cochlear implant, it is not known how many electrodes will be necessary for the brain to be able to make coherent images out of it. But as they are continually shrinking these devices, and as a matter of fact, the next generation will also have the entire device, except for the external camera, in the eye itself, that small, so that the power pack, the receiver from the light that is taken from the camera, external camera, will be transmitted through the lens of the eye, will be picked up by this little apparatus in there, and will that will be translated in, or will create the power to operate this, number one, and number two, take the visual information and send it off to the implant, which will replaces the rods and cones and puts impulses of electricity into the retina, which then goes ahead in the other cells that are still viable, or hopefully still viable, process that information and send it along to the optic nerve. Hmm.
How many people, roughly speaking, now have undergone this procedure?
I'd say roughly maybe about 50. Hmm. There are, I think, now the epiretinal implant is being developed in this country primarily by a company called Second Sight in Sylmar, California. And they have implanted a number of people. And then there's another kind of retinal implant, which I mentioned earlier, called the subretinal. Mm-hmm. That's being developed by a company in Chicago called Optobionics. And that implant sits on the back of the retina. And actually, the rods and cones are on the back of the retina. Interestingly, if you look at the cross-section of the retina, the light enters the eye and goes through the retina to the back side of it where the rods and cones are, and then the signals are processed back up towards the inside of the eye, if you will, and to the optic nerve. The epiretinal, or the subretinal implant, I'm sorry, goes in the back of the eye, and it doesn't require a camera at all, and a number of people have been implanted with this. And it is sort of a miniature photovoltaic cell, and the designers of this implant are operating on the assumption that the light that enters the eye will activate this small photovoltaic cell, if you will, not dissimilar to the kind that's being used to create electrical energy from the sunlight, and will that will be enough energy to activate to replace the action of the rods and cones and send the signals up through the retina. It's a rather that's controversial, because there are some people who say that who feel that these photovoltaic cells will not create or do not create enough electricity to replace the rods and cones to send the signals up through the retina to the optic nerve. But some people have been implanted and have had positive results with them. The controversy also involves what generates the results. One of the developers of that particular implant thinks that it's therapeutic. His sense of it is that what's happening is the implant is stimulating the nerves and creating what's called neurotrophic factors. And that is that nerves feed each other, if you will. They, as a nerve functions, it gives off chemicals that help nurture neighboring cells. And so what his hypothesis is, that people who are experiencing positive results with this are their neurotrophic factors are being stimulated by the fact that the retinal implant is stimulating the nerves. Other people say that it's what's called a rescue effect, and that is that some people say you can just inject a saline solution into the eye of a person with retinitis pigmentosa, and sometime, and for reasons unknown, can have a therapeutic effect for a period of time, and then it will disappear. But people who have had this subretinal implant have been able to see some light, make out some images. I spoke to one woman who had one of these implants who had retinitis pigmentosa and was able to make out some difference between light and dark, and that was about it. And she said she can actually see the numbers on a large digital clock, and she can see the large printing on a cereal box. So there's a lot of promise with these things. Yeah.
We are at our midpoint here, just a tiny bit past, and I have a number of callers. We'll bring them into the conversation. We're talking here about the recent developments in the field of neuroprosthesis. It's something that our guest, Vic Chase, writes about in his book, Shattered Nerves, How Science is Solving Modern Medicine's Most Perplexing Problem. Books published last fall, and it is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have several. We'll start with our line number one, and this is someone listening in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get back to the topic of the cochlear implant. I used a video, Sound and Fury, in a class of mine this past school year, and so I watched it several times, and there were several people in the video who had been implanted with the cochlear implant. And there seemed to be a large variation of success in terms of how well they were able to use spoken language. And the guest was pointing out that it's really the young babies who do the best with it, because they then are able to learn spoken language as the same as hearing children. But even just a couple of years delay can really make a big difference. And there were some children in the video who had been implanted at age 5 or age 7, and when they spoke, first of all, they said they couldn't understand everything that they heard. They didn't give percentages, but it wasn't not like hearing children would be. And when they spoke, they sounded much like deaf children did. And I think that it's important to see the cochlear implant as part of a program that is intended to help the child acquire spoken language. It's not, you know, if the child has had no spoken language input and then all of a sudden can hear, that doesn't mean that they can understand and use language, spoken language, the way hearing children can. So that was just one thing that I wanted to point out. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chase, you want to comment on that at all?
No, I think from what I know that the caller is quite accurate, that there's a wide range of responses, and some people actually do not have success. In my book, I do not try to one of the things I was cognizant about when I wrote it is I don't want to give false hopes to people with disabilities. By the same token, there really is, I think, the potential for great hope for many of these. The cochlear implant has been around for a couple of decades now, and there are many, many thousands of people who can use it to recognize speech. And as I said, from what I understand, the majority of people, not all by any means, but more than half of the people who have the modern cochlear implants can carry on telephone conversations, which is really something for people who were otherwise profoundly deaf. And as a matter of fact, the FDA, initially when they approved the cochlear implant for implantation, it had to be, because of the risk-benefit factors, if you will, somebody had to be profoundly deaf before they could receive a cochlear implant. And at the outset, children were not allowed to receive them. And as they've proven their worth, the requirements have become more liberal for people who have can receive cochlear implants. And then they've also made it available to younger and younger children.
Let's talk with someone else. This is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have some comments to just add about a center that the university has here. It's called the National Center for the Design of Biomimetic Nanoconductors, funded by the NIH, and also is part of a collaborative with the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. And one of the ultimate or the primary goals for the center is to look at how biomimetic nanoscale design can be utilized in devices to achieve the functions that membrane transport accomplish in biological systems. And so the center itself is working at the confluence of theoretical, computational, experimental methods for understanding and quantitatively characterizing biomembranes. One of the projects which is ongoing at the center is a biocompatible biomimetic batteries, what is characterized as bio battery, so to speak, to power an implantable artificial retina extendable to other neural prostheses. And so the broad design essentially is mimicking or following the electrolyte of the electric eel, which would generate large voltages and current densities by stacking large areas of electrically excitable membranes in series. So, of course, the advantage, perceived advantage for this technique or the biomimetic battery is the lack of toxic materials and the ability to be regenerated by the body's metabolism. So I just wanted to bring up to speed as far as this campus is concerned in terms of some of the ongoing activities in this area of neural processes.
Well, I appreciate the call. I guess what this generally also suggests a larger issue, and it is something that you talk about in the book, is that when we're talking about implants, we're talking about putting some kind of foreign device into the body.
Right,
you're going
exactly,
to have to make
right.
sure that it's something that the body is going to feel okay about having in there, and particularly if we're talking about we're putting something into the saline atmosphere of the body, which is something that tends to promote corrosion. So there's all sorts of material science kind of questions involved in developing materials for these implants that the body will accept.
Absolutely. That's a very perceptive observation because that's a very good point. I'm glad that the caller and you made that. And that is that these neural prosthetic implants are really miraculous devices. One of the things that drew me to write about this was two things. One was my fascination with the people involved, both the patients who have volunteered to have these experimental devices implanted in their bodies, as well as the researchers who are developing them. And they're an interesting group of people all the way around. I got a little bit off the track. The miraculous part is that today, because of the miniaturization of electronics, vis-a-vis the invention of the transistor and integrated circuits and so on, man can think about developing devices that can be implanted into the delicate tissues of the human body. And material science is a very, very important part of it, because you're putting something in the environment inside the body is very similar to that of salt water. It's largely salt water. So, as you said, corrosion is a very important factor that must be dealt with. And some materials, and that's one of the things that has been ongoing in the development of these prosthetics. And biomimetics, the term that the caller used, is sort of a newly coined term, if you will, and it refers to actually developing things that mimic the biology of the body. And that is being worked on right now, because not only do you have to build something that can withstand the environment in the body, it's got to withstand it for a very long time. You can't go implanting things inside the ear or inside the eye or inside the muscles or inside the brain and then replacing them periodically. So they've got to last for a good long time. And secondly, the body, you have to devise them such that the body does not reject them. And so it's not rejection is of foreign bodies. You get a splinter, and if you don't pull it out, your body will work to eventually shove it out. Well, it attempts to do the same thing with anything that it doesn't recognize as its own. And biomimetic, and there's a lot of work in the field going on at a lot of research institutions right now, is aimed at developing implants that, if you will, fool the body to think that, into thinking that the implant that is put in is part of itself, and therefore accepts it and does not build scar tissue around it and rejects it. And one of the things that is a problem still today in retinal in some neural implants is the rejection factor in the body. For example, when they put electrodes in the brain, and that is being done in humans as well right now, primarily to record signals from the brain as opposed to inject signals, as is the case with the cochlear retinal implant, and their scar tissue builds up around those electrodes and makes them less functional. And so that's an issue that's being dealt with by this whole field of biomimetics.
Well, let's talk with somebody else. Someone on a cell phone, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Quick question or comment or both. A couple of callers ago, a lady mentioned you have to learn how to speak after you can hear. It may also be, it probably is, so that you have to learn how to see as well, and that some brain mechanisms are actually hardwired to see such things as edges and motion and things like that. So cochlear as well as visual implants may necessitate learning, and of course work better on real young kids that still have a lot of brain development ahead of them. My question is, how exactly do these things work? Let's take the cochlear case, because that's kind of more linear than visual. And the visual case is, those little hairs, as I understand it, each hair is associated with a frequency and also a nerve. And the nerve eventually winds up someplace in the auditory cortex. And that nerve means that particular frequency. For instance, pilots in Vietnam, helicopter pilots in Vietnam, very often lost the hearing of the particular frequency of the transmission whine in their helicopters because it was so loud for so long. And so they no longer could hear that frequency. Apparently the hairs had been damaged, or the nerve between the hair and the brain. Now, given that each hair is a tone, how do you get an implant that vibrates or that activates more than one hair? Activates only one hair with only two implants. I would think that it would take a number of electrodes to activate a range of frequencies in the ear. So exactly how does that work? Sorry for a long-winded question, but that's what I was wondering.
Okay. Well, can you talk about that a little bit, Mr. Chase?
Yes. As I mentioned earlier, the cochlea is tonotopically arranged with low frequencies, and then as it curls in the snail shape design, the frequencies go up, so that it is well known where the hair cells are located that react, if you will, to specific frequencies. And those hair cells in deaf people are no longer functioning. So the cochlear implant, the electrodes, the processor, feeds the appropriate frequencies to the nerve fibers of the auditory nerve where the hair cells normally would do so. And what so if an electrode is where the low frequency cells that react to low frequencies is located, then the processor will, is set up to feed low frequencies to those particular groups of cells, and that particular part of the auditory nerve, I should say, and that's how it works. They program the processor, if you will, to feed the appropriate frequency signals to the appropriate part of the cochlea, and because it's so neatly arranged tonotopically, they know precisely where to feed precise signals. And of course, you can't. One of the things that you can't do with these is feed to individual nerve fibers. They just send it to the groups of nerve fibers in the areas where they know that these particular various frequencies are processed. And as I mentioned before, the brain does the job, and with the 22 electrodes, people can recognize speech.
So you know, it's not, for example, within music, there's a very wide dynamic range. So
right.
That's not going to be possible, for example, for people perhaps to hear everything in a piece of music. But if you optimize it for that range of frequencies where most of human speech is, the sort of the mid-range where the human voice is, you can give people enough information so that it makes it possible for them to understand speech. It still might not be quite as full as a normal hearing person gets, but enough information so that they, as you say, that in many cases there are people who could carry on a phone conversation with somebody else and would be able to understand that person well enough to be able to talk to them.
Precisely. Yeah. And there's a wide range of abilities that people have with the cochlear implant. Some people can enjoy music with it. That's as again one of the people that I spoke about earlier, who had one of the early experimental devices with six electrodes, four of which were functioning initially, was a lover of music before he went deaf, and he went deaf in his 20s and was able to eventually enjoy music. There are so many technological hurdles, and that's why I mentioned that these things are pretty miraculous devices, not just putting the electrodes into the cochlea, but the processing of the sound. And a lot has been done to develop and improve processors, not only the way the signals are fed in. It's almost like an early RCA Victrola compared to the stereophonic sound that one can get today. The early implants were rough and didn't have that many electrodes, and the processors were not that sophisticated. Today, the processor for cochlear implants are little small things that hook over the ear, very much like they're hardly noticeable, very much like a hearing aid does. And they pick up the sound, process it, and transmit it through the skin to the receiver in the skull. And so some people, as I said, can actually enjoy music.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus with Victor Chase. His book, Shattered Nerves, How Science is Solving Modern Medicine's Most Perplexing Problem, is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. It's about research in the area of neural prosthesis. And just one, we have here been talking quite a bit about just one example, that is the cochlear implant. There's also a big section in the book. We probably will not get talked very much about this.
Unfortunately.
Dealing with a very large area called functional electrical stimulation, which
right.
is being used to try to help people who, through accident or some other cause, have lost the use of limbs. And this is, I think, is a very really fascinating and I'm sure very for a lot of people very exciting area to think about. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. Someone down in Southern Illinois on our line one. Hello.
Good morning, and thank you for this program. Sure. I do hope you have the author back to discuss the spinal cord. And my question is.
Well, thank you.
My question is on the retina, and I'm interested in knowing the difference between the prosthesis and stem cell, and how close are we to common use in one or the other.
That's a very good question, and there is no precise answer to it. The researchers I've spoken to at the companies developing the retinal implants think that within perhaps 5 years, there will be enough electrodes in the epiretinal implant so that people can actually have functional implants implanted so that they will provide some real usable functionality for them and perhaps become clinically available. That's part of the research, and it's not easy to answer at all because the question still remains as to how many electrodes would be necessary for the brain to actually see full images. It's really not known, just as it when in the early days of the cochlear implant, it was not known how many electrodes it would take for people to hear speech. And there are some people who actually think that, say the brain is not a television set and that it might not be able to make coherent images out of spots of light. By the same token, and so there's a whole other area of visual implants as well, which we haven't touched on, which are visual cortex implants, where they actually put electrodes instead of putting them in the retina, and this would be especially useful for people whose entire retina is damaged through either disease or accident. And what they, in this case, do, and it's been implanted experimentally several times in humans, put electrodes directly on the visual cortex of the brain, which is in the back of one's head, and feed impulses directly into that via the electrodes. And people with those have been induced to see the shapes of letters. The same with the retinal implants as well, by the way. The question as to precisely when, with research like this, they will be clinically available is really not easily answerable. And I can't speak to the stem cell portion of it because that is not something that I included. I covered in my book the area of neural prosthetics alone, as is evidenced by the fact that we've just scratched the surface in this conversation, is large enough for an encyclopedia, let alone stem cell, which is another story.
Okay, one more quick question. Besides your book, where else could one go for more information on websites that maybe you might have used in your research?
Information on neural retinal. Prosthetics generally?
Yeah, for a retinal research. Specifically the retina.
Yeah. Well, Second Sight is one company, as I mentioned, they're out in California, and they're developing the epiretinal implant. Optobionics in Chicago is developing the subretinal implant. Then the there is a biomimetic center, I forget the exact name of it, which is based at the University of Southern California. And I'm sure if you go to their website, you can find the biomimetic center, which is doing actually... the head of the Biomimetic Center is a fellow named Mark Humayun, who was one of the inventors of the retinal implant being developed by Second Sight. He and a fellow named Gene DeJuan developed it. Those are some places you could check, and I think if you just go ahead and Google retinal implants, you'll get a lot of hits.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And we'll try real quick to get a comment here. Line number two, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi, I was going to ask about stem cell because it seems like a nice non-bionic way to deal with this problem as opposed to using the technology. I don't advocate not having research in either of them, but it just seems to me that replacing it with something that doesn't have to unlearn, the previous method and learn a new one would be quite a bit better. But the poster boy for this is Rush Limbaugh, isn't he? I mean, he seems to have burn out his retinas by or his cochlear nerves by using too much opiates. And I'm just I'm wondering if for people who are managing chronic pain, how much? I mean, was it, do you really have to worry about that? I realize this is a little off the wall, but I had a little comic relief at the end here. But I'm just saying that I think that stem cells are seem to be, maybe that's your next book. I'm not sure. maybe they can interact.
Well, that's an idea. Maybe I'll pursue that.
We are at the point here where, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop. And as we've said, that there is another very large area that we have not talked about, dealing with people different kinds of disabilities, trying to supply them help. For example, people who are quadriplegic, making it possible for them to do things like stand up and walk, other sorts of things. You expect we're going to be hearing more and more about this kind of research in the years ahead?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. This functional electrical stimulation, it's too bad we don't have time to talk more about that, is a very exciting area where there are implants developed that are enabling people, quadriplegics, to actually move a hand, to be able to groom them and feed themselves and even operate a computer. There's an area of part of that also is bowel and bladder. There's a bowel and bladder system which has actually been approved by the FDA, which is on the market. And there's a chapter in my book called The Dirty Little Secret, which is about the fact that is not commonly known, but people who are paralyzed below the waist do not generally have bowel and bladder control, and that can lead to serious complications. This implant helps alleviate that. And then there are also cognitive implants being developed, which might, at some point, way down the road, help replace memory loss. And deep brain stimulation is also part of this whole mix, where deep brain stimulation is being used clinically today for people with Parkinson's disease, but it's also being tested on people with intractable depression.
Yeah, well, we're simply going to have to stop. If people want to read more, you can look for the book that we've mentioned, Shattered Nerves, How Science is Solving Modern Medicine's Most Perplexing Problem, by Victor Chase. It's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Mr. Chase, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.